This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last Tuesday, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki defied critics who've described him as overly cautious and launched a determined attack on Shiite militias in the southern oil port city of Basra. A week later, it appears that Prime Minister Maliki has lost, both militarily and politically. To begin with, government forces could not contain the battle to Basra, and fighting erupted in many cities, most importantly in Baghdad. Some police and soldiers defected. Those that remained loyal made little headway against fierce opposition, and U.S. and British forces were called in on what was touted at first as an all-Iraqi operation. After announcing a fight to the finish, the prime minister now appears to be looking for a way to save face. What happened? Why? And what does it mean for the future of the prime minister, of his principal rival, Muqtada al-Sadr, and for the future of Iraq? Our number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, on the opinion page, the literary passions that can make or break a romance. But first, the intra-Shia war in Iraq. And joining us now from the Pentagon is NPR's defense correspondent, Guy Raz. Hey, guys.
Hello, Neil.
And let's take a step back to last week, Guy. Why did Maliki launch this attack on Shia militias in the first place?
Well, there are a number of reasons. I mean, for at least a year, there has been essentially a power struggle in southern Iraq. You've got what amounts to a struggle between the government parties. The government parties are the Dawa Party and the ISKI Party, the Supreme Islamic Council. And their primary rivals are the Sadrists and their militia, known as the Jaish al-Mahdi. And essentially for the past year, as I said, there's been this power struggle for, in some senses, control over resources. Of course, two-thirds of Iraq's oil resources are in the southern part of the country. Access to ports, issues like trade, and of course, consolidating their political power base. All of this essentially has come to a head now after a year of skirmishes, political assassinations, and, of course, pressure from the U.S. military in Iraq on Maliki to go into Basra and essentially to establish and to assert government control over that city.
British forces who had been in control of Basra province for, of course, since the invasion, well, they've largely withdrawn. It's been turned over to Iraqi control, and British forces are now up in an airbase outside of Basra.
Right. And ever since that time, Basra has essentially been controlled by militias, by these competing forces. Some of the militias not only loyal to the government, but essentially part of the ruling government. And the other main militia group, the Jaish al-Mahdi, obviously loyal and controlled by the Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, who is based in Iran.
And so as government forces, though, went in, they encountered what the defense minister later admitted was unexpectedly stiff resistance.
Right. And that was Abdul Qadir who essentially had to concede this because Maliki went in. He went in, you know, blazing guns with 16,000 Iraqi ground troops, the biggest, by the way, Neil, the biggest Iraqi army operation since the Saddam Hussein days when they invaded Kuwait. I mean, this was an enormous operation by Iraqi standards. They went into Basra. Maliki himself flew down to the city to oversee this operation and now finds himself in a position where he has essentially underestimated the strength, the ability, the power of the Sadr militias, the Jaish al-Mahdi.
Or the Mahdi Army, as it's often called in shorthand on American airwaves. A stunning development on Sunday when Muqtada al-Sadr from Iran issued a statement calling for, well, a kind of ceasefire.
Right. And you know, I think looking at that statement, I mean, part of it is that Sadr was under pressure from the Iranians. Sadr, as I said, is in Iran. He's studying as a religious religious student at the moment. He's studying to become an ayatollah, essentially a senior religious scholar. And, you know, he's no fool. I mean, he understands that in order to consolidate his power base, he has to play the the political game. He's essentially made his point. He has shown that the Iraqi government and the army doesn't have the power to defeat him and his militia. And he's also shown that he has a significant amount of control over virtually his entire militia. He called on them to essentially, you know, cease fire for the time being on Sunday, to lay down their arms. And they have, by and large, done so.
At the same time, this does present him with the mantle of a statesman, too. He's the one for calling for the bloodshed to stop.
Right. And, you know, what's interesting is Sadr has to be looking forward to the planned provincial elections in Iraq in the fall. He wants to see Basra as a sort of a wellspring of power, a place where he can really sort of put his stamp down. And with that in mind, Sadr wants to show that he's also a political player and that the government essentially has to talk to him. They have to deal with him.
We're talking with NPR's Guy Raz from the Pentagon about the last week's battles between forces in Iraq, government forces and Shia militias, mostly in Basra, but in other cities in Iraq as well. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Peter's on the line calling us from Berkeley, California.
Hi. Well, I'm glad that you've started to discuss this stunning development, as you said, that al-Sadr seemed to call for a stop to the fighting. I think this is a tremendous opportunity. It's a victory for everybody, and we should seize on it and start having talks or whatever can possibly be done to capitalize on this great indication. You know what I'm remembering right now is when Dan Rather interviewed Saddam just before the invasion, Saddam asked for a televised debate with Bush. And, of course, he was ignored, but looking back, he shouldn't have been ignored.
Well, maybe or maybe not. It doesn't bear much relation here. Is this a moment? Is this an opportunity, do you think, Guy Raz? Or...
Well, that's the sense in which it bears a big parallel.
Well, let's see if Guy can answer the question.
You know, Peter, I think that it is an opportunity in some ways, but in some ways the main issue isn't going to be resolved with negotiations over the course of the next week or even months. I mean, the issue ultimately has to do with resources and a competition for the resources between the main Shiite factions in southern Iraq. What's interesting, you talk about this as sort of a positive development. There's no question that a ceasefire is. The U.S. military has also sort of seen positive aspects over what's been happening over the past week, essentially saying, look, no matter how you view the fighting in southern Iraq, it shows that the Iraqi army now has an operational capacity that it didn't have 6 months ago, that it can actually carry out basically independent military operations without too much U.S. military aid and backing.
Peter, thanks for the call.
Well, thank you.
Let's go next to Daniel, and Daniel's calling us from Rice Lake in Wisconsin.
Hello. Could Maliki have launched the attack without the approval of the United States or the United States military?
Guy?
There's no way he could have done it without at least the knowledge of the U.S. military and MNFI, Multinational Forces Iraq. And as we've pointed out earlier, he has been under some significant pressure from the United States military to carry out an assault like this. But, you know, I talked to a military official in Iraq earlier today. One official essentially said, look, I'm not certain, and he was speaking on background. He said, look, I'm not certain that the Iraqi army was actually prepared to launch the full scale of what they had envisioned so quickly. I mean, there is support to a certain extent, obviously, among military officials, U.S. military officials in Iraq, but I think also surprise at the way it was executed.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
And as we stand here, I guess tomorrow it'll be a week since this attack started. Where do the forces stand now? Who's in control of Basra?
Well, right now, the situation is that the Sadrists control at least a third, and that's according to the U.S. military, but probably more of that city, Neil. It's essentially quiet now, based on the reporting we're getting from Basra and in parts of Baghdad. There were sporadic attacks on the Green Zone in Baghdad earlier today, but it is relatively quiet, which gives you a sense of the extent to which Sadr really has significant control over his militias. You know, there's a lot of talk about what are called special groups within the Mahdi army, the Jaish al-Mahdi, these sort of rogue elements within the Mahdi army that are not loyal to, that do not follow Sadr's orders. But by and large, it seems like the Mahdi army has stood down for the time being.
We'll have to see where it goes next. Guy Raz, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you, Neil.
NPR's Pentagon correspondent Guy Raz with us today from our Pentagon Bureau. At the heart of the fighting that stretched through the weekend is that power struggle between Iraq's Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki and Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Rend al-Rahim, a fellow at the United States Institute of Peace, also Iraq's former ambassador to the United States. She's met Prime Minister al-Maliki several times. She joins us today here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
And at this point, it's hard to seem to escape the conclusion that Prime Minister Maliki took a gamble and lost.
You know, I know Maliki doesn't look very good after this, but I wouldn't jump to the conclusion that he lost. I mean, right at the beginning, we were saying that Maliki has lost militarily and politically. I think that is a bit of a hasty conclusion. He certainly showed a lot of determination and muscle in wanting to go down to Basra and to fight the rogue elements and the militias. And Basra really has been a city out of control for quite a long time, not only since the British withdrew and handed over to the Iraqi army in November, but really even before that, even while the British were there, the question of the militias control of the city has been a rankling one, and it has been a real challenge to the Maliki government and to the writ of the state over Iraq, and Maliki had to meet that challenge in some way. He could not simply ignore it. Now, he didn't come out with flying colors, but I think to say that he has completely lost politically and militarily, I think this is premature. I would like to comment on this issue of opportunity. And I think it is an opportunity in a number of ways.
And we'll talk about that when we come back from a short break, and we'll include your voices in the conversation as well. What does the battle between the government forces and Shia militias in Basra and elsewhere in Iraq spell for the fortunes of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, for Muqtada al-Sadr, his principal Shia rival, and for the future of Iraq? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. There's a lull in the fighting in Iraq, at least for now, but the power struggle between Iraq's leading Shiite political factions appears far from over. Iraq's Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki and Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr are the two men at the center of that conflict. Our guest is Rend al-Rahim, a fellow at the United States Institute of Peace. She's met Iraq's Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki several times. If you have questions about how the fighting or how Sadr and Maliki will affect the future of Iraq, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also read what other listeners have to say at our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. And before we go on and look into the future, Rend al-Rahim, you've said this is premature to call it a failure on the part of Nouri al-Maliki, either politically or militarily. Nevertheless, to have called, I think it was last Thursday, for a fight to the finish, we're going to finish this, you know, this will be concluded, and then to negotiate an agreement a few days later.
Yes, indeed. I agree, but I think Maliki may have learnt certain lessons from this, and the Dawa Party and ISKI would have learnt lessons about their ability to make political decisions in the South without taking into consideration the Sadris. They have at least now come back and said, okay, we are going to need to negotiate with the Sadris on all kinds of political decisions and bring them back into the government. The issue of regionalization in southern Iraq is something that they're going to have to discuss with the Sadris. This is another issue other than the provincial elections. So Maliki is in a better position to assess his own strength and the strength of his coalition vis-a-vis the Sadris. So there is an opportunity for more dialogue after this. And perhaps this would be the useful part of the exercise.
Muqtada al-Sadr is often referred to as a firebrand, or as a visionary, or as a radical, depending on who you're talking to. For a little more on Sadr, Newsweek editor, senior editor Michael Hirsch joins us here in Studio 3. Michael, nice to have you back on the program.
Thanks for having me.
And will Muqtada al-Sadr regard this as a victory, do you think?
I think so, yeah. It lays to rest one questions in a very public way, obviously, about whether he has control over the Mahdi army, which, as Guy was pointing to earlier, have been percolating now for several years, partly because no one really knows where he is. He resurfaces occasionally, is said to be in Iran, and now, obviously, he's said to be in Qom, the religious city south of Tehran. At the same time, as you just pointed out, it shows that Maliki was not able to follow through on his stated intentions of not negotiating, of routing Sadr's forces. And finally, it makes him look magnanimous, which has been a goal of Muqtada's ever since he sought to assume his late father's mantle. His father was a well-known Ayatollah who was murdered by Saddam in 1999. At the time, Muqtada was a very young man, about 25, was known to some people as Mullah Atari because he spent a lot of his youth or misspent it playing video games. And so he has been trying since then to take on a much more mature political role. That's why you see some of this back and forth, between the fireband rhetoric. He'll alternate from that to seeming to be the political, the savvy political player.
And as opposed to his, there were, I guess, a couple of real Donnybrooks with American forces back in 2003, 2004, 2005. At those times, the demands that Muqtada al-Sadr would issue during these conflicts were far-reaching.
Yeah.
Shall we say, this is a much more modest set of demands that he issued on Sunday.
Oh, no question about it. From the early days of his rhetoric demanding that Americans depart, his alleged role in the murder in the streets of a rival Ayatollah Abdul Majid al-Khoei, who was a favorite of the Americans, who was brought to Najaf in April of 2003 and was murdered allegedly by Sadr's followers. There was an arrest warrant issued during the early coalition provisional authority regime of Jerry Bremer. He was an outlaw then, very much so. But the arrest warrant was never followed through. And since then, he has been trying to maintain his viability, if you will, on both sides, both with the Iraqi Shiite community by being seen as their protector and by increasingly allowing himself to come under the umbrella of the U.S.-authorized Iraqi government. So he's playing both sides and, seems to be doing pretty well at it.
And Rendal Rahim, let me ask you, during the what we call the ceasefire, or the last couple of years that Muqtada al-Sadr has not asked his forces to not attack government and U.S. forces. There have been a lot of reports that the Mahdi army, the JAM, has become splintered into groups which include people running protection rackets, thugs, if you will, as well as the kind of people who are continuing the social programs that the party became known for as well. Nevertheless, is that part of what Nouri al-Maliki might have seen as his opportunity a week ago?
It seems to me that what Nouri al-Maliki wanted to do, apart from the political agenda of weakening the Sadris, is really to go after all the militias that were in Basra, part of which were these special groups that are out of control, out of the control of the Sadris, in the pay of the Iranians, and so on and so forth. And in some way or the other, the whole thing got out of control, and the target became the Sadris. The Jaish al-Mahdi, the Mahdi army, is a very nebulous body. It's very difficult to say who they follow, who controls them, and the likeliest explanation is that they are, in fact, a fragmented group and very localized, that they have local leaderships in provinces and towns and so on. But it's very interesting that when Muqtada al-Sadr said, cease and desist, we did see everything stop. Mm. Now, what does that tell us about the special groups? That they are listening to the Muqtada al-Sadr, or that they simply feel threatened right now, or are they pulling back in order to resume activities later on? It's very hard to tell, but certainly the Mahdi army is not a disciplined, unified force that is completely controlled in a hierarchical manner.
Mm-hmm. And Michael Hirst, let me ask you a broader political question. Mm-hmm. Do these two men have very different visions for Iraq? They're both Shiite political leaders as well. Is this an argument about who's in control or what the future of Iraq is going to be?
Well, I think both, obviously. I mean, Maliki is basically a secular leader whose vision, he's not entirely secular, but his vision is in accord, more or less, with that of the U.S. in terms of bringing Iraq into the international community, whereas Sadr, you know, has much more of a Shiite cleric's view of the future of Iraq. But beyond that, I think that they, you know, obviously is a power play going on here in a very deep and serious way. It was said during the early days of the Maliki government that he was, you know, beholden to Muqtada al-Sadr. It's clear that their rivalry for control of the future of Iraq and the future of the vision of Iraq has become, you know, has gone much more out in the open now. At the same time, Maliki is being, you know, pressured by the U.S. to take action. There is a lot of political pressure back here that has, you know, not a little to do with the 2008 presidential campaign to show that the surge is succeeding not only militarily but politically. And obviously this was an attempt by Maliki to show that his central government has control over what is now an effective Iraqi army. And that's where he got, you know, slapped in the face a little bit.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Chuck. Chuck with us from San Francisco.
Thank you very much. The question I wanted to ask was very much along the lines of the question you just asked, so I'll extend it a bit and say, if Maliki is the and the groups he represents are favored by the U.S., what's the relationship between Sadr and Iran?
Between Sadr and Iran, Muqtada al-Sadr and Iran. Rendal Mati, Rahim?
Yeah. I would like to just say one thing, that Maliki is not a secular leader. He is a Shiite, from a Shiite religious party. And his coalition actually is with the Supreme Council, Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq, which is very much of a Shiite religious party. This is their agenda. Now, the fact that
relative to Sadr.
Well, he is a friend of ours relative to Sadr. But I don't think in terms of the religious content of the ideology, it's perhaps a few shades less religious than Muqtada al-Sadr, but they certainly are. They used to be called the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, the major Shiite party that he's allied with.
But that's not Maliki's party.
No. Dawah party, by the way, is no less religiously based than the Supreme Council. But going back to Iran, of course, the eminence grise in all of this, the force that is always there, the ghost in the room, is always Iran. What is Iran thinking? What is Iran saying? Iran has a lot of horses in this game. Iran backs all sorts of parties, all sorts of Shia parties in the south and the center and so on. There are even rumors that Iran probably backs or may back some of the Sunni insurgent groups. We don't know that for sure, but there is talk about that as well. So Iran's fingers are all over the place. Now, what is the relationship between Iran and Muqtada al-Sadr? Muqtada al-Sadr has always presented himself as the Iraqi nationalist, as opposed to the Dawah and the Supreme Council, who are said to be pro-Iranian and influenced by Iran.
They were forced into exile and spent many years in Iran, both those parties.
Correct. In fact, the Supreme Council was formed in exile in Iran in the early 80s. So Sadr presents himself as the populist, nationalist Iraqi force in Iraq, and that his connections with Iran are limited, and that he does not favor Iranian influence. Nevertheless, we know that Iran has embraced the Mehdi army, has helped train them, has helped support them financially and with weapons. And right now, Muqtada al-Sadr is, in fact, in Iran studying to be a serious cleric. So I think Iran plays all sides in its favor.
And Michael Hirsch, I guess that raises a question about the United States, who, as we heard at the beginning of the program, while this is an Iraqi operation mounted by Iraqis, Iraqis are in charge. Nevertheless, in the last couple of days of the fighting on Saturday and Sunday, U.S. and British forces were called in.
No, that's right. And again, it's maybe too early to say who comes out a winner and loser in this. I mean, on the side of Maliki and his U.S. backers, one has to point to the relative quiet in both Baghdad and Basra and say that perhaps some of these special groups got slapped around pretty well, particularly by that American air power
And that, U.S. Special Forces,
yes, that came in
the, ground
in the
too,
last
yes.
few days and could have made, you know, could have made a difference in the fighting. Nonetheless, you know, where are the these sort of loose truce lines, if you will, are shows that the militia haven't really lost much ground. And, you know, in another sense, it may be, you know, yet the latest misreading of the military and political situation in Basra, which, as the ambassador pointed out, has always been controlled by these various militias, even when the British were there. I mean, I can remember the last time I was in Iraq in April 2006, there was a great deal of talk about how little control the British had back then. So these guys were entrenched for several years, and it was perhaps unrealistic of Maliki to think that, you know, within a few days' time he could rout them.
That's Michael Hirsch of Newsweek magazine. Also with us is Rend al-Rahim, a former ambassador of Iraq to the United States. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And as we move ahead, as we look, Rend al-Rahim, you're talking about an opportunity. Well, if there is an opportunity, Nouri al-Maliki will be presumably negotiating from a position of less strength than he had a week ago.
More wisdom and more caution. You know, there are several agendas on the political table right now. One of them actually is the provincial elections, which are supposed to take place before October. And so there is a struggle for power in the South and the resources of the South as to who is going to control the electoral provincial councils. That's one. And it sort of gives Maliki and the Supreme Council, that Shiite bloc, a little bit of a pause to think about how they can strengthen themselves, and that the South is not automatically theirs. The other very important issue is regionalization. The moratorium on forming regions in Iraq expires in April. And there is a strong possibility that the Supreme Council will want to move ahead with a proposal to form a huge region in southern Iraq. That has been the policy of the Supreme Council all along. And Maliki's party, the Dawa party, does not endorse this entirely, but I think Maliki goes with his stronger ally. The Sadris, on the other hand, do not want this large region in the south. And there is going to be a battle of forces over that particular issue. And the opportunity here is to give the Supreme Council pause to say, can we actually go forward with the regionalization as soon as April, given the forces that are arrayed against us, that are very real, that are strong, and that it's not easy for us to eradicate? Mm. So what it creates is a draw on the political level in which every side has to go back and attenuate or tone down their positions and their aspirations. It stops everybody from going from maximalist positions.
And Michael Hirsch, do you agree?
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. And the strange geometrical hinges by which we look at these things, it also makes Sadr in an odd way an ally, you know, of the U.S. and its vision, in that Bush is obviously determined to keep Iraq together. Sadr is the nationalist, perhaps even more than Maliki, although I think Maliki has, you know, largely adopted that vision, but certainly more than the Supreme Council, the other large Shiite party. So you have to figure out how to play that one.
Nevertheless, one of the defining characteristics of a state is an organization which has a monopoly on force. And
exactly.
This is clearly not the situation in Iraq. The Iraqi government forces have just apparently suffered a defeat at the hands of the Mahdi army. We've been talking about the Skiri party, the Supreme Council. They have militias of their own. It's called the Badr Brigades. There are a lot of militia forces out there that are not necessarily insurgents. And Maliki, whoever is going to control the government of Iraq, has to control these militia groups.
Well, that's right. But he may not. And, you know, rather than a monopoly on force, which you may have for Iraq, keeping Iraq together for a long time to come, may be the largest plurality on force. And that could well be the Iraqi National Army. I mean, I wouldn't just classify this as a defeat. It is important to note, as your reporter did before, that this was the first time they made a show of force largely on their own until they were backed by the U.S. But as, and this gets, you know, gets again, back into the political campaign here, what John McCain has been talking about in terms of a presence, a longtime presence in the Iraq, is largely about this as a backup, whether it's our air power. I mean, I can tell you, you know, in the last trip that I made, there certainly was a lot of buildup of U.S. air power and, you know, repairs made to the air base at Balad and places like that, preparing for a longtime presence. And I think that's what this is about.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Michael Hirsch, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Michael Hirsch, a senior editor at Newsweek. He joined us here in Studio 3A. And thanks also to our guest, Rend Al-Rahim, a fellow at the United States Institute of Peace and Iraq's former ambassador to the United States. Ambassador, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
When we come back, have you gotten over the bad haircut or opposing political views, but maybe some relationships just cannot withstand Tom Clancy or Nicholas Sparks on the bedside table? What are your literary deal breakers for romance? Join us next coming up next. Stay with us. We're going to do something. If you'd like to get in on that conversation, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Maybe we'll start the next host contest. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.